Rock.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today will be the final narration from the Traditions of Glastonbury by E. Raymond Catt. And we're going to be looking at King Arthur and the Last Supper. One of the traditions of Glastonbury, proudly upheld by the 11th century AD monks, was that the Glastonbury Abbey was the resting place of the sepulchre of the renowned British king, Arthur. Arthur's heroic deeds of valour in his battles with the pagan Saxons and the Picts were sung by the bards of old. After his last great battle with his usurping nephew Mordred at Camlan in Cornwall, Arthur was dying of fatal wounds. The king asked to be conveyed to Glastonbury by water. Tennyson describes the scene, his hero speaking to his brave knight, Sir Bedivere. "But now farewell, I am going a long way. With these thou seest, if indeed I go, for all my mind is clouded with a doubt, to the island, Valley of Avalon, where falls not hail nor rain or any snow, nor ever wind blows loudly, but it lies deep-meadowed happy, fey with orchard lawns and bowery hollows, crowned with summer sea, where I will heal me of my grievous wound." So said he, and the barge with oar and sail moved from the brink like some full-breasted swan. In all Western history, there is no story that brings more emotional response than the legends of the fabulous King Arthur, his noble knights of the Round Table, his great sword Excalibur, and his beautiful Queen Guinevere. Arthur lived in the late 5th and early 6th centuries AD. At that time, Britain was the scene of a bloody struggle for domination between the Britons and the invading Saxon tribes and their allies, the Picts and the Scots. What is known of Arthur is slight. One of the earliest recorded mentions of him was written by Nennius, who lived about 2 centuries later. He wrote that Arthur fought together with the kings of Britain, but that he himself was the Dux Bellorum, meaning general or leader. In all probability, Arthur was a great warrior, a man of immense strength and skill at waging war. Many ancient documents have been found, each reporting a series of violent battles between the Celts and the allied Saxons and Angles. Always an unnamed warrior, the leader of the Celts, was depicted as a man of unimaginable power and a great leader. One may wonder why such an important leader was not named in so many instances. One possible reason is that the wars waged by Arthur imposed necessary but hard taxes on the people to sustain the country's survival. Since the monks were the historians of the day, being the only ones who could write, their revenge upon Arthur took the form of omitting his name from all historical records, referring to him only as a great warrior. As countless centuries rolled by, the facts of Arthur were lost in the myths and seemingly miraculous legends, which, in time, diminished the credibility of the whole story. By the 19th century, many came to believe that no such person as King Arthur ever existed. Was there really such a man? Is there substance behind the fantastic exploits of the Knights of the Round Table? The legends of King Arthur began among the Welsh bards of the 7th century. They were first printed in Caxon in AD 1485, in the chronicles of Sir Thomas Malory, called The Mort d'Arthur. In more modern times, scholars began to have doubts as to the authenticity of the main facts of these legends. There are those that contend that many of the legends are altogether due to the imagination of the Welsh bards, with perhaps only the slightest of historical foundations for these stories. Some historical writers, on the other hand, acknowledge Arthur as a Romanized Briton of the 4th century, who fought to maintain Christianity against the hordes of Picts and other barbarians from the north. Modern research has lifted the shroud of mystery from the legendary figure. Arthur emerges as an immensely dominating leader, and his knights may well be figures of real personages distorted by time and the fiction of the romanciers and writers of fables. The magical sword of Arthur can be shown to have some basis in fact, and the Holy Grail a reality. Arthur emerged as the military genius of the Britons in AD 512, owing to his crushing defeat of the Saxons at the Great Battle of Mount Badon. This deed is found to be well documented by the chroniclers of the period. A formal search was made for the grave of Arthur in the year AD 1191 by Henry de Soliaco, who was appointed abbot of Glastonbury after King Henry's death in 1189. Malmesbury records that King Arthur and his Queen Guinevere were buried in the monk's graveyard between two pyramids. Matthew O. Paris also mentioned that in AD 1191, Arthur's remains were found between two antique pyramids. Giraldus Cambrensis, Gerald of Wales, who professes to have been an eyewitness to the search, relates that at the depth of 7 feet, a large flat stone was found. On the underside of the stone was fastened a lead cross. The cross was taken from the stone, and on the underside, facing the stone, were the words Hic jacet sepultus inclitus Rex Arturius in insula Avalonia. Here lies buried in the island of Avalon the renowned King Arthur. The cross is lost, but a 16th century engraving suggests that it dates from before the 10th century, when St. Dunstan, abbot of Glastonbury AD 936, is said to have raised the level of the cemetery. The clay terrace which he formed has been found, and it would have buried any earlier memorial. The lead cross, most likely, was a label replacing the original stone stela, which one would expect to find, marking the grave of a 6th century general such as Arthur. Below the stone, at a depth of 9 feet, was a huge coffin of hollowed oak, which, when raised to the surface and opened, was found to contain 2 cavities. At the head, and occupying 2/3 of the space, were the bones of a man of gigantic proportions, with a large skull, bearing 10 wounds, 9 of which showed signs of healing. A woman's bones rested in the remaining 1/3 of the coffin. With her bones was a tress of yellow hair, perfect in form and colour, which on being touched fell to pieces. Arthur and Guinevere had been found at last. Their remains were first removed to a chapel in the south aisle of the great church, and later moved to the middle of the presbytery. In the year AD 1278, King Edward I and his Queen Eleanor kept the festival of Easter at Glastonbury. The mausoleum containing the relics was opened for their inspection, and by their order, the remains placed in separate caskets and sealed in a black marble tomb. In front of the high altar, the skulls of the king and queen were to remain outside for the adoration of the people. The tomb is recorded as having survived until the dissolution of the abbey in AD 1539. Remains of the tomb were found in 1931 in the western part of the choir near the original position of the high altar. Excavations in 1962 and 1963 unearthed a socket which had been used as a base for a stone pillar, probably a cross. Around the socket were fragments of 16th century pottery, suggesting that the monument had been destroyed at the Reformation. Originally, the cross stood about 40 foot south of the Lady Chapel, opposite the second window from the eastern end. 15 foot further south was the wrecked remains of a small semi-underground tomb chamber, or hypogeum. This is the type of tomb shrine to which the term pyramid applies. Between the cross and the tomb chamber, a large hole had been opened late in the 12th century and refilled after a very short interval. The hole went down into natural soil, destroying two or three of the earliest graves, including one set close against the tomb chamber, indicating it belonged to a man of power and standing. The location of the grave and the date of it having been opened leaves little doubt that the burial it once contained was the one the monks identified as Arthur and Guinevere, as reported by medieval writers. Not only does Glastonbury claim King Arthur's body, but it may also be associated with the site where Arthur is reported to have given up his famous sword Excalibur. When John Leland, King Henry III's antiquary, wandered through Somerset around the year AD 1542, he found on the River Brew, a mile from Glastonbury, a bridge of stone of four arches, commonly called Pontilus, where men fable that Arthur cast in his sword. The bridge crosses the river between Glastonbury and the town of Street. In AD 1415, the river's Latin name was Ponspericulosus. Today, rebuilt several times, it is still called Pompales. On John Overton's map of Somerset, 1668, it is marked as Pompales Bridge. The question is often asked, why should the Holy Grail stories be bound up with the Arthurian legends? And the answer is not too difficult to find. Arthur was not merely a great military leader, but an avowed Christian. His Christian faith was one of the tools with which he bound Britain into unity, and with which he opposed the forces of local rivalry, local tyranny, and local ambitions. But perhaps the strongest link is found in the pedigree of Arthur, his direct descent from Joseph of Arimathea. The genealogy of King Arthur is given by the historian John of Glastonbury. He lists Arthur as the 10th descendant from St. Joseph of Arimathea. The following pedigree is taken from John's manuscript, giving Arthur's descent from Joseph through Arthur's mother, Helios, Nepos Joseph, Genuit Joses, Josu Genuit Amenadab, Amenadab Genuit Filium, Qui Genuit Igernum, De qua rex Pendragon, genuit nobilum et famosum regum Arthurum, per quod patet, quod rex Arthurus disturpi Joseph descendit. Note, the original meaning of the Latin nepos is not nephew, but grandson. If, as it can be believed, Joseph brought the cup used at the Last Supper with him, when he came to Britain, then its discovery would have been of tremendous importance. Here would be a relic, sanctified by the centuries in Britain, and by right of descent, belonging to Arthur. It could have been used as a symbol of Arthur's power to represent the Christian unity of Britain, overriding both the authority of the regional kings and the opposing forces which Arthur could barely hold in check. In one of the earliest of the Grail literatures, the Grand Saint Grail, we are told that after the death of St. Joseph and Josephus his son, the keeping of the Holy Grail was given into the care of Alain, the son of Bronze and cousin to Josephus. At Alain's death, his brother became Grail Keeper, and after him six kings, the last of whom was Pelles. King Pelles, through his daughter, who married Sir Lancelot, had a grandson named Galahad, who became the special hero of the Holy Grail legends. Tradition has it that Galahad, as well as all of the knights of the Round Table, were descended from Joseph of Arimathea. If true, the relationship between Arthur's knights and the Judahite Joseph would explain the curious and startling digressions concerning King David, King Solomon, and Judas Maccabeus mixed in with the legends of the Arthurian knights. In Mort d'Arthur, which contains the quest of the Sangreal and the high history of the Holy Grail, scholars can trace the Grail stories into dim pre-Christian times and further to the east of Palestine. The theme, apparently, was taken over and Christianized with outstanding success. However, the Sage of the Grail, the pagan cup of plenty that became the Sangreal, the Sangreal, the chalice containing the holy blood, and the mysterious source of life, healing and prosperity, had nothing whatsoever to do with Arthur, Joseph of Arimathea, or the Christian chalice, the cup of the Last Supper. Many legends have grown up around the story of the cup of the Last Supper. King Arthur and his knights bound themselves in solemn oath to find the Holy Grail. They braved many hazards in fruitless search. Some of our most beautiful literature is written around the quest for the Holy Chalice. We are still intrigued with the mystery of the cup. What was its ultimate fate? The answer may well lie in the tradition of Glastonbury that Joseph of Arimathea had the cup in his possession when he arrived at Avalon. He is said to have buried it within the cloaking earth of Chalice Hill, from which flows the waters of the Chalice Well. Belief that the original cup of the Last Supper was brought to Glastonbury and buried there has existed for over 1,000 years. The strength of this belief is shown to us in the many poems, songs, and stories that abound. Tennyson immortalized the tradition of the cup coming to Glastonbury in the following verses that he wrote. The cup itself, from which our Lord drank at the last sad supper with his own. This from the blessed land of Aramat, after the day of darkness, when the dead went wandering o'er Moriah. The good saint, Arimathean Joseph, journeying, brought to Glastonbury, where the winter thorn blossoms at Christmas, mindful of our Lord. And there a while it bode, and if a man could touch or see it, he was healed at once, by faith, of all his ills. But then the times grew to such evil, that the holy cup was caught away to heaven, and disappeared. To whom the monk, from our old books I know, that Joseph came of old to Glastonbury, and there the heathen prince Arviragus gave him an isle of march whereon to build, and there he built, with wattles from the marsh, a little lonely church in days of yore, for so they say these books of ours, but seem mute of this miracle, for as I have read today, but who first saw the holy thing today? While colourful and romantic stories picture the cup of the Last Supper as a gold or silver chalice, a Passover dish, even the Holy Grail of the Arthurian legends, one is inclined to believe that the cup was a plain drinking vessel, perhaps of wood, as was widely used in the Middle East at the time of Christ. Just such a cup exists. The Nantios cup, which for over 4 centuries rested in the House of Nantios in Wales. The story of this gnarled olive wood cup starts with the destruction of the monasteries by Henry VIII in his ruthless war against Roman Catholicism. At the time of the destruction of the Glastonbury Abbey, Richard Whiting, the last abbot, entrusted a wooden cup to his monks to carry away to safety. He described the cup as the most precious treasure of our abbey. The monks fled across the border of Wales, and for a while they were safe in the remote but now ruined Cistercian Abbey of Strata, Florida. But when Henry's men entered Wales and approached the abbey, the monks again had to flee, this time in the direction of Aberystwyth, which suggests they may have intended to escape by sea. After some 15 miles trudging over mountainous and marshy terrain, the monks arrived, travel-stained and weary, at Nantios Manor, situated in a secluded valley 3 miles from Aberystwyth, where they sought shelter. Sympathising with their plight, the Lord of the Manor, Mr. Powell, and his wife extended a warm welcome and an invitation to stay and make Nantius Manor their home. It is believed that the prior became the family chaplain, while the elderly monks were employed in light work on the 5,000-acre estate. As the years passed, the little band of monks dwindled in numbers as one by one they passed away, until only one monk remained. In the course of time, he too lay dying in his bed when he called in the Lord of the Manor to reveal to him his secret of being the custodian of the Holy Cup. After delivering the cup into the hands of the Powells for safekeeping, he charged them that the cup should remain at Nantios Manor until the church claims her own. During the succeeding centuries, the cup became known as the Healing Cup, as miraculous cures were claimed by those afflicted by various sicknesses after drinking from the cup. A specially made glass bowl was fashioned to hold it so that chips could not be bitten from the rim by sick folks who believed that the healing water taken from the cup would be more efficacious if a chip of the wood were consumed with it. Often, the cup was lent out briefly for the relief of local people too sick to travel. Watches and jewellery were left as pledges against the cup's safe return, and then left permanently as thank you offerings for recovery. Among the many written testimonies of healing is one that reads, 3rd of August 1862, the cup lent to William Jones Llanbadarn left a silver watch, returned 4th September 1862, case cured. Another reads, 27th of November 1857, cup loaned this day to William Rowlands Estrade Tregarnon, use of his sister, wholly cured, left £1, returned 2nd January 1858. Letters of gratitude bear witness to more recent cases. In one, dated 1939, a clergyman vouches that two children afflicted with epilepsy drank water from the cup and were cured within a few weeks. Others tell of cures for fever, rheumatism, and arthritis. As reports of these astounding cures spread over the surrounding countryside, pilgrims from all over Britain, and even from overseas, began to journey to Nantios to drink water from the famous healing cup. A remarkable and more recent story is about a local Roman Catholic priest who sipped water from the cup and was immediately cured of crippling rheumatism. Father James Wharton of St. Joseph's Church, who died in 1966 at the age of 75, is remembered by many people of the town of Upton-upon-Severn in Worcestershire, England. Father Wharton had been so crippled by rheumatism that he was unable to bend his legs at the knees. His miracle happened on August the 21st, 1957, the day he journeyed 100 miles to the house of Nantios. There, he drank from the battered wooden cup, then sank to his knees and prayed. Immediately afterwards, the priest arose, his knees bending without difficulty, as he walked from the room effortlessly and free from pain. Witnesses, including his housekeeper, Miss Phyllis Woodward, were able to describe the remarkable transformation. Divested of its remarkable history and miraculous cures, the cup is not an impressive sight. Here is no silver chalice shining with spiritual light, as in the stories of Malory and Tennyson, but instead a battered piece of wood that looks more like half a coconut shell, blackened and broken. Reduced to about one-third of its original size by centuries of wear. Originally, it would have measured about 5 inches in diameter at the top, and about 3 inches in depth, tapering to a base about 2.5 inches across. Its edges are dented and pitted with the teeth marks of overardent pilgrims. Are the remnants of the Nantios cup the remnants of the cup used for the sacrament at the Last Supper? Does it really have healing powers? The present owner of the cup requires no further proof that the cup she cherishes is indeed the wonder-working cup of the Last Supper. If she ever had any doubts, they were forever dispelled in 1959 when a ladder fell and broke the skull of her youngest daughter, Jean. The hospital reported that her case was hopeless because of severe hemorrhage. Thereupon, Mrs. Myrilus took the cup from its box and prayed. Minutes later, hospital personnel telephoned to say that the bleeding had suddenly stopped and the child would live. Jean completely recovered to become a healthy child. Coincidence? Perhaps. But in myriad and mysterious ways, faith works wonders that defy scientific explanation. Whether the cup has extraordinary healing powers, or whether it was only a vehicle to motivate one's faith, is a moot question. Many believe that this humble wooden vessel is the cup of the Last Supper, and who, in all sincerity, can say that they are wrong? Consider the traditions of Glastonbury. They cannot be dismissed as mere fables, for legend is not fiction, nor is truth confined only to that which can be established by documentary evidence. It is a fact that legends and traditions are generally rooted in a basis of truth. In the absence of positive proof to the contrary, there is no reason why one would not accept traditions as having a foundation in fact. Some may dismiss all legends and traditions in the absence of clear, reliable documentary records. However, we must remember that the whole of Britain's history, for the first 500 years of the Christian age, is almost entirely blank as regards to written records. As we have seen, such is not the case with the traditions of Glastonbury, because certain authorities have testified in times past to the truth of the traditions. Admittedly, some eminent British scholars reject the antiquity of the traditions, holding that they were stories concocted by the Glastonbury monks to attract pilgrims and their money to Glastonbury after the destructive fire of AD 1184. However, while rejecting all earlier historical references to the traditions of Glastonbury as later interpolations and not supported by clear evidence, they invariably admit it is not impossible that the legends are factual. Some may say the founding of the abbey by Joseph of Arimathea and other disciples of Christ is perfectly unprovable. But to many other minds, it is at the same time perfectly credible. Its greatest probability is underwritten by uninterrupted traditions. The mystical charisma of the cumulative legends and traditions of Glastonbury has, for over 1,000 years, drawn pilgrims from all parts of the world. It is not without reason that William Blake, the poet and mystic of the 18th century, penned his famous Glastonbury hymn with its haunting and challenging question, never answered in the affirmative or the negative. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among those dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till I have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. It is perfectly clear that William Blake meant to convey his belief that Jesus Christ did come to England before he began his ministry in the Holy Land. At the age of 14, Blake became an apprentice to a London engraver, and one of his engravings in those early days of his life was of Joseph of Arimathea. He shows us plainly, both as an engraver and as a poet, that he was aware of Christ's visit to England's green and pleasant land, and that it had impressed him deeply. We may never unravel all the mysteries surrounding Glastonbury, but the traditions of Glastonbury, like truth, will never die. Legend and history are inextricably mingled, making it difficult to differentiate between truth and legend in some instances. However, Glastonbury is the holiest earth in England, and the spirit of its traditions is still vibrant and alive, close-knit with a living Christ.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.